All right.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody. Today is February 23rd, 2026. And, you know, like for one day, I saw my grass. I've been living on this glacier that they call Pennsylvania for the last couple of years. And well, for the last few months, everything's been pretty much white out there. For like a couple of minutes, I saw my grass and the snow is back. Everybody in the Northeast is buried. So I hope everybody is enjoying the kids being home, doing their remote learning days, like is probably happening halfway across the country this morning. But that's not the big news this morning. The big news this morning, uncertainty reigns supreme once again. And it's kind of funny because it's not like we had a lot of certainty when it came to trade and trade deals and the tariffs and the not tariffs and the taco and the not taco and the circus of the last year with the on-again, off-again tariffs via tweet. Well, the Supreme Court struck them down on Friday. It didn't really come as that big of a surprise to people. You could kind of tell based on the language that the justices were using in their questions during the hearings that they were leaning this way. Also, the language that was used in the court's decision didn't really surprise me at all. Basically said Congress has the authority to tax unless otherwise explicitly laid out in the law. And it was President Trump's use of IEEPA, or the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, that the Supreme Court struck down. They said basically that IEEPA does not give the president carte blanche to go just unilaterally impose tariffs on anything of any percent. Now, President Trump answered almost right away. You had the market rallied a little bit on that news. Within a matter of hours, President Trump came back and said, we are putting global tariffs on everybody of 10%. This time under a different statute. He used the Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974. Now, that allows the president to impose tariffs in order to correct things, including a huge balance of payments deficit, in other words, a trade deficit, which the United States clearly has. But there are some caveats to that. He's only allowed to go up to 150 days on these tariffs. Extending beyond 150 days requires congressional approval, which he is almost certain not to get. There's also a limit of 15%. Now, President Trump came out and said 10% on Friday. And that struck me as kind of odd because I remember I was saying on our Patreon Zoom call while we were talking about this, he left 5% in the chamber for some reason. Maybe he wants to leave himself room to escalate. Well, that didn't last. Within a matter of hours, he's like, you know what? We're going all the way up to the maximum allowed by the statute of 15%. Now, this morning, the question is, what happens to all these previously announced trade deals, to all the investments in United States manufacturing and data centers and chip factories, and we're going to bring manufacturing back? What about all the deals to buy liquefied natural gas or buy agriculture products and soybeans? What happens to all these deals? Well, we're starting to find out. You've got India has canceled a trip. They were supposed to send their delegation to the United States to sign on the dotted line of the trade deal that they had signed just a few weeks ago. That trip has been canceled. Obviously, the Indians having second thoughts considering the fact that the Supreme Court just struck down the tariffs they were supposed to be negotiating for. Europe has immediately frozen their trade deal that was settled just a couple of months ago. I'm sure we're going to see other countries doing the same thing. Now, it's also important to keep in mind that the Supreme Court struck down the IEEPA tariffs. Again, that's the reciprocal tariffs, which were struck down. There are other tariffs that have been levied based on Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, things like tariffs on steel and aluminum, tariffs on auto parts. Those tariffs were not subject to the Supreme Court's ruling, so they're still in place. And then there's all kinds of specifics. Okay, the new tariffs, do they stack on top of those 232s or not? Well, we're going to clarify a little bit of that. We have some of that news in the articles that we have today. What I think the president is going to do is during this 150 days he has under this 122 tariff, he's probably going to announce Section 232 investigations into freaking everything. And those 232 investigations will be performed while we're under the 150 days of the Section 122 tariff. So you staying with me here? All these overlapping statutes. And then right as those 150-day tariffs expire, I don't know if they'll be able to do 232 investigations in that much time or not, but he'll probably try to roll right into those. So, I mean, you're probably sitting here scratching your head saying, section what? Who's a what's it? Yeah, that's the whole world right now. Nobody freaking knows. And you know what? The world wants certainty. The markets like certainty more than anything else, and they ain't getting it. Also going on this morning, we've got more worries about private credit here, in particular Blue Owl Capital, who was all over the news last week when they gated investors in their OBDC2 fund. Lots of red flags being raised. Lots of comparisons. They're comparing the Blue Canary, if you will, to the run-up to the GFC this morning. That's some pretty strong language. Companies like Blue Owl, Ares, Apollo, the big players in private credit, their stocks are all down 20 to 30% year to date, getting absolutely clobbered here. We had an activist investor on Friday. This story came out late Friday. Bose Weinstein, an activist investor, launched a tender offer for investors who got locked inside of this Blue Owl fund, which is really what set off all this consternation last week. They're offering between 65 cents and 80 cents on the dollar for people's shares in this fund that they are now no longer able to sell. So that's interesting. If they're offering 65 cents on the dollar, that means they think it's worth more than that. But if anybody accepts 65 cents on the dollar, it's because they think it's worth less than that, or they just really need their money back. They're really illiquid. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out, how many of these investors are willing to accept that 65 to 80 cents on the dollar tender offer that has been offered. And if significant numbers of people do accept that offer, well, it's further proof that the marks in private credit are rather doo-doo. Also going on in the private credit space this morning, CLO equity funds are getting absolutely destroyed. This Bloomberg article mentions a couple of specific ones that are down 15 to 40% since the start of the year. CLO stands for collateralized loan obligations. In other words, you take a whole bunch of these garbage loans, like, for example, the loans that Blue Owl has issued to software companies in particular have been hurt lately. You package them all up into a bond and you sell them to unsuspecting retail investors. Does this sound familiar? Didn't they make a movie about this? Yeah, but I digress. Yeah, those funds are getting clobbered here. Nobody wants anything to do with them. And of course, we have got big news in the AI space. We had one hell of a Friday news dump from OpenAI, and it wasn't really a dump from OpenAI. Some of the participants in their latest fundraising round leaked OpenAI's financial projections to the information. And well, those projections are pretty interesting. Right on the top line here, you've got revenue outlook for OpenAI through 2030 has increased by 27%. So OpenAI really wants you to focus on that revenue, baby. Oh, that annual recurring revenue or the revenue run rate. It's on the up and up. Double-digit growth, 27%. That's great. Everybody, stop reading right there. Don't read any further. Because the next line down, you find out that their cash burn is projected to double. Oh, that's kind of big news. Hey, our revenue is up by 25%, but our losses are up by 100%. And remember that the point is to make money, right? I mean, I understand it doesn't seem like it because companies are rewarded for losing money left and right in this market. But I thought the whole point was to make money eventually. I feel like the kid from the Silicon Valley show, like, isn't the point of business to make a profit eventually? No, silly rabbit. But yeah, $665 billion they're going to burn between now and 2030. All right, understand that, guys. That means they need to raise $665 billion just to survive, just to flatline, not grow, not nothing, just to stay alive. So keep that in mind when you hear these stories about, oh, we're raising $20 billion from Amazon or $30 billion from NVIDIA, round-tripping schemes, yada, yada. $665 billion and rising. And then even more important after that in these OpenAI financials, was in this information article. They're talking about how their infrastructure spend through 2030 is now projected to be $600 billion. That is down from $1.4 trillion that they had previously claimed in the press. So that is significant. While their cash burn rate is doubling, the amount they're investing in compute just dropped by $800 billion through 2030. That is money that will be coming directly out of hardware sales, right? And I got my eye on you, NVIDIA, reporting your earnings later this week. NVIDIA earnings on Wednesday. They are sure to be fantastic. All the hyperscalers are increasing their CapEx. I'm sure all that is going to result in NVIDIA posting amazing numbers, raising their guide again. But we have now had three consecutive quarters where the market didn't care, especially last quarter when initially the market rallied heavily on NVIDIA's earnings and then sold off and ended up closing red on the day. It has gone nowhere since pretty much August of last year. Well, that's on Wednesday. It's going to be a busy week. We also got news in Mexico. Mexico was an absolute smoky mess yesterday. Cartel boss El Mencho was captured by the government and killed yesterday, and the cartel went on a freaking rampage nationwide. There was smoke. There was images all over Twitter yesterday of smoke billowing from the air, roadblocks set up, dead police officers and army soldiers all over Mexico. The Guadalajara airport was shut down when the cartel attacked the airport. The U.S. State Department told tourists to shelter in place. Now, it seems like things have calmed down overnight, and I use that term loosely because there are no articles this morning suggesting any escalation from there, although maybe it's just those articles haven't hit because everybody was hunkered down overnight. We don't know what's going on there, but trade across the border with Mexico is about 4% of U.S. GDP, roughly, give or take. If that violence were to somehow continue or start spilling over the border, you could conceivably see things like border closures, which would, well, be very bad economically. So stay safe if you're in Mexico. I don't know why anybody would be in Mexico. People have asked me, hey, we should go travel to Mexico. I hear it's nice. And I said, no, why would you ever want to go there? Well, I mean, look, the cartel is showing us that they are the power in Mexico right now. That is, they are asserting their control over the country. I mean, it's long been a conspiracy theory. Do we have to do this? I don't really think you need one of these to believe this, but the cartels have been running Mexico for probably the last 20 to 30 years. And the Mexican government is just this like gaggle of administrative muckety mucks that the cartel allows to survive as long as they do what the cartel wants. And they're kind of stuck between the U.S., who has been telling them for years, do something about the cartels. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll do something about the cartels. And then they look over at the cartels and they say, don't kill me. We're not going to do anything about you. Well, that all is coming to a head right now. We'll see how that one plays out. Hey, why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance today. Normally, I say don't forget that like button and that subscribe button. But right now, instead, I am going to mention George Noble's Best Stock Ideas Online Summit, which George was very nice enough to invite me to present at on March 11th. You will notice a link down in the description below where you can get your tickets to that event, which I will be speaking at along with a long list of very accomplished investors and financial elites. So if you want to come see me at that summit on March 11th, click on that link, get your tickets now, and I will see you there. Thank you very much, George, for the invitation. I'm honored and humbled to be included in that list. Also going on this morning, the S&P 500 is down about 18 points, well off its lows of the morning, down about 0.25%. The Dow is off by 154 points, 0.3% in the red this morning, and the NASDAQ is down 118 points, about 0.5% lower. So stocks are down across the board, but much better than they were looking last night when I went to bed. The Dixie is lower by 18 basis points, 97.62 for the U.S. dollar, down a little bit this morning. Looking over at the bond market, we've got the 30-year yield at 4.711%. That's lower by about 1.5 points. The 10-year yield is at 4.063. That's off by 2.5 points. The 2-year yield, 3.476, lower by almost 0.5 point. And the 1-month treasury, 3.691, down just a fraction of 1 point. Again, not a lot happening in the bond market this morning. Metals are looking good this morning here. We've got gold is up by more than 100 bucks here. Again, when the market doesn't see certainty, the market goes where certainty can be found, and certainty can be found in gold, typically. But allow me, before we get into the price, allow me to posit this one thing, and I mentioned this on a Spaces with George Noble over the weekend and also on the Patreon Zoom on Friday. How much of this run-up in gold and silver over the last few years has been due to tariff uncertainty? All that metal that went from London to New York in the first quarter of last year, driving GDP negative because they were worried about tariffs on metals, it led to a shortage in London and a big arbitrage opportunity, and both prices started to rise, and then metal started flowing back to London in order to capture that arbitrage. That was all driven by tariff hysteria. How much of this upward move of the last 2 years or so that we've seen in gold and silver prices was driven by tariffs? I don't really know. But this Supreme Court ruling and the uncertainty in the tariffs, it is conceivable that this could cause problems in the precious metals market. I don't know if it's problems that send metals higher or problems that send metals lower. I've got more questions than answers when it comes to that, but that's worth keeping an eye on. In the meantime, spot gold higher, $55 or about 1.1% at $5,160. April COMEX gold futures are up by about 100 bucks, almost 2% higher, $5,179. Spot silver is at $86.48, up by $1.83 or 2.2% higher. We hit overnight highs of $87.84. We're getting closer to that big 9.0 again. March COMEX silver futures, $86.28. That's higher by $3.94 or about 4.8%. I like the shiny. Copper is the lone metal. Nope, not the lone one, but one of few metals in the red this morning. Copper's down about 0.5%. Platinum is also down 0.5%. Palladium up by 0.6%. And crude oil is higher by about 0.5% here, $66.80 for April WTI futures. Still no news out of Iran other than the ongoing military buildup here. Nothing to report on that front. Bitcoin, meanwhile, had a brutal day yesterday. Bitcoin was not happy. Down, it was at one point down around 64,000. We've bounced off those lows, $66,101 this morning, off by about 1,500 bucks from yesterday. Now, we have an interesting article here. Hedge funds that piled into U.S. Bitcoin funds are the first to exit. It appears most of the selling over the last few months has been from hedge funds. Hedge funds that helped fuel a boom in U.S. ETF funds holding Bitcoin are in rapid retreat. Aggregate Bitcoin ETF allocations among the largest hedge fund holders fell 28% from the third to the fourth quarter of 2025. That's according to data compiled by CF Benchmarks, a wholly owned subsidiary of crypto exchange Kraken. Bitcoin is down almost 50% from its October peak of over 126,000. Well, everybody was very excited about the ETFs when they were rolled out in 2024. And for sure, that sent Bitcoin prices sharply higher as people piled in. But that door swings in both directions when people pile out of the ETFs, like, say, the clients of hedge funds, and those hedge funds start dumping the ETFs. They start selling the underlying Bitcoin. That can take the price down every bit as much. So it appears most of the selling since the third quarter has been those same hedge funds. All right. Meanwhile, we've got this one in Bloomberg this morning. This is the big story, and this is they're going to be talking about this in the financial press probably for the next few weeks. Global trade confusion returns as Trump overhauls tariff toolkit. The Supreme Court's nixing of U.S. President Trump's reciprocal tariffs is throwing fresh confusion over the raft of trade deals negotiated by global partners as the inescapable reality of ongoing levies remains a threat. Now, that's a pretty powerful statement there to start. The inescapable reality of ongoing levies. Yes, the Supreme Court struck down most of those tariffs, but they're coming back. They're just going to look and smell a little different. The European Union is poised Monday to freeze the ratification process of its agreement with Washington, according to Bloomberg. Meanwhile, Indian trade officials postponed a trip to the U.S. that would have aimed at concluding their interim accord. Now, the European thing didn't surprise me at all. The Indian story is interesting because we talked a lot over the last few weeks about India was buying Venezuelan crude oil instead of Russian crude oil. And a lot of the impetus for that transition has been the punitive tariffs that President Trump put on India for buying that Russian oil. Well, those punitive tariffs were just struck down by the Supreme Court. So is India going to go right back to buying that Russian oil, or are they going to keep buying the Venezuelan crude? We don't know, but the trade delegation that was supposed to go sign that deal canceled their trip. Not exactly a good sign. The Trump administration swiftly announced plans to replace the prior tariffs with a new across-the-board 15% levy on U.S. imports. While that creates temporary winners such as China and losers, including the UK, it leaves the overall weighted tariff rate only marginally lower for the American businesses and consumers actually footing the bill. Senior U.S. officials said the tariff defeat at the Supreme Court won't unravel deals negotiated with U.S. partners. Well, the U.S. partners get a say in that. The new import taxes will be based on Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act, which allows the president to impose tariffs for 150 days without congressional approval under specific circumstances, including large and serious balance of payment deficits. The Supreme Court decision may appear to be a major blow to the administration's tariff policies, but its trade agenda can be pursued through other avenues, said Mike Reed at RBC Capital Markets. That means little relief for U.S. companies and consumers paying the levies. Economists at Goldman Sachs, including David Merkle, estimate that the combination of the Supreme Court ruling and the newly announced Section 122 tariffs will reduce the increase in the effective tariff rate since the start of 2025 from just over 10 percentage points to 9 percentage points. The court decision and the new 15% tariffs are a stark reminder to all of us that we're now facing a very unpredictable and uncertain operating environment, said Singapore's Deputy Prime Minister Gan Kim Yong. The key word really is uncertainty. And that statement there, that is the takeaway from the Supreme Court ruling. The key word here is uncertainty. So let's see if there's a little bit of clarification here, because remember, those were the IEEPA tariffs that were just struck down by the Supreme Court. There were other tariffs that President Trump has put in place. Detroit auto industry spared from Trump's latest tariff program. Detroit's automakers learned Friday night that they had been spared from tariffs that President Trump imposed after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down most of his global duties. Trump on Friday night put in place a flat 10% levy on foreign goods that is to take effect on Tuesday. That has since been raised to 15%. But in a fact sheet, the White House affirmed that passenger vehicles and certain truck and auto parts would not be subject to the duty. Those tariffs, as well as those levied against steel and aluminum, were implemented under a law that gives the president authority to impose import taxes on national security grounds. Those duties were unaffected by the Supreme Court's ruling that struck down Trump's broader import taxes imposed on many countries. All right, so those auto tariffs, those steel and aluminum tariffs, those were Section 232 tariffs that were imposed under the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. Those tariffs were not struck down by the Supreme Court, so they're still in place. And what this article is saying, the new 15% levies that are being done under the 1974 Trade Act, those will not apply to steel, aluminum, and autos, which are being tariffed under Section 232. I know this is confusing. I'm trying really hard to get my section straight here. I don't want to say the wrong thing here. All right. So basically no change for the auto industry, no change for steel and aluminum. Also, it looks like Mexico and Canada will not be changing, at least not very much. Mexico and Canada exempted from new U.S. levy as USMCA risks loom. USMCA, that's the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the very not creatively named trade deal that was cut during President Trump's first term. U.S. Supreme Court's decision to strike down many of Donald Trump's tariffs offers some relief to Mexico and Canada, but a much bigger set of risks still hangs over the trade relationship that joins the three countries. The president said Friday afternoon the U.S. would impose a 10, now 15% levy on foreign goods under a different law. It took several hours before the White House clarified that it's leaving in place an exemption for many goods shipped under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. So this new 15% tariff will not apply to the USMCA goods, much like the reciprocal tariffs did not apply to the USMCA goods. On Saturday morning, Trump said in a social media post that that would be raised to 15%. The exemption means the effective tariff rate for Canada and Mexico will decline. Until the court's decision, products that didn't qualify for the USMCA exemption were taxed at 35% if from Canada and 25% if from Mexico. So now they will be 15%. And again, this is only for the non-USMCA goods. Those will be still be exempt under that trade agreement. And, you know, the risk here is that President Trump somehow torpedoes USMCA entirely in order to get those USMCA goods to be tariffed under that new 15% levy. I don't know if he's going to do that. Bloomberg is speculating that he could here. Again, guys, uncertainty. It's the name of the game here. Nobody freaking knows. Now we got to talk about private credit again. This one also in Bloomberg this morning. Blue Owl Capital's decision last week to permanently shut the gates of one of its funds is rattling the $1.8 trillion private credit market. Take a second to appreciate the size of that number there, guys. $1.8 trillion. This market is big enough to wreak havoc in the global bond market. Investors have been pulling money from such funds because jitters over the disruptive power of AI and lending standards more broadly, and it's evoking comparisons to the run-up to the global financial crisis. Now, what they're showing here is the stocks of Blue Owl in yellow, or maybe that's orange, Ares Capital Management in black, and Apollo in gray there. And all three of them are down high double digits just since the start of the year. with Blue Owl down, what do we got, 27.6%. It's down again this morning. We've got Aries is down 23, almost 24%, and Apollo down 17%. The private credit space is getting destroyed this year. The red flags we are seeing in private credit today are strikingly familiar to those of 2007, said Orlando Jeames of Fourier Asset Management. Sorry if I mispronounced your name there, Orlando. He pointed to worsening lender protections and convoluted liquidity terms. Private credit has in recent years transformed from a niche lending market to a linchpin of global finance. It's now backing everything from data center operations to multi-billion dollar buyouts of software makers and healthcare companies. The timing is especially awkward because Wall Street is rushing to bring private assets to the masses, trying to convince 401k retirement plans to add such funds to get tougher when investors are blocked from exiting. And if only somebody had been warning you for months that this was happening, that this garbage was being dumped into our 401ks because it won't be accurately marked until they've gotten it off their books and into grandma's retirement. And well, it looks like the prices are falling before they can even finish that. But yeah, that timing isn't awkward, Bloomberg. That timing is actually on purpose. They're dumping this into people's 401ks because they know this is coming. They knew this was going to happen, and they don't want to be owning it when it happens. So they are selling, as Jeremy Irons would say, to willing buyers at fair market value. Yes, I didn't get in that chair by being the smartest person in the room, Mr. Told. Even as that's going on, this story broke on Friday. Bose Weinstein's Saba and Cox launch a tender offer for Blue Owl BDCs. This story is going to be interesting. How many people will accept this deal is going to tell us just how worthless this private credit really is. Activist investor Boaz Weinstein is offering to buy shares in Blue Owl Capital's business development companies after a challenging week for the lender and broader fears about bubbling risks in the $1.8 trillion private credit market. Saba Capital Management, which is led by Weinstein, and Cox Capital Partners launched the tender with an offer price that's expected to be at 20% to 35% discount to the most recent estimated net asset value and dividend reinvestment price. That will be determined when the tender offer starts after a 10 business day notice period, Cox and Saba said in a statement on Friday. So the net asset value, that's basically what Blue Owl tells you the loans in this fund are worth. And Saba Capital Management is offering to buy from those investors at a up to 35% discount to that net asset value because those investors were just told you can never sell it, which means who knows what it's actually worth. It means Blue Owl is afraid of what it's actually worth. And so Saba seems to think it's worth more than 65 cents on the dollar, but less than 100 cents on the dollar. They're trying to capture that arbitrage somehow. The price that any tender clears at will provide a window into where the market gauges the value of these funds and if it reflects Blue Owl's internal net asset value, which it clearly won't. Steeply discounted exits could hurt future fundraising efforts. The purchaser's tender offer would provide a liquidity solution to retail investors in the wake of a significant industry-wide increase in BDC redemption requests. Multiple quarters of net outflows and a rise in redemption gate provisions, said Saba and Cox. What they're saying here is these business development companies, which are basically funds made up of these loans, a lot of people have been asking for their money back. They don't want to sell those loans to give people their money back. So they told people you can't have your money back. And now Saba and Cox are saying, we'll buy it from you at a steep discount. The move comes just days after Blue Owl decided to restrict withdrawals from one of its private credit funds, facing a looming deadline to return cash to investors in Blue Owl Capital Corp. II, that's that OBDC2 fund, also known as OBDC2, it raised capital by selling $1.4 billion of portfolio loans to three North America's biggest pension funds and its own insurance firm. And I just love that last part there. Last week, all these private credit apologists that were on CNBC trying to circle the wagons and reassure everybody that Bear Stearns isn't going bankrupt. I mean, reassure everybody that Blue Owl Capital was fine and there's plenty of liquidity. They were all talking about this $1.4 billion loan sale. And what they didn't mention until the next day, we found out that it was Blue Owl's own insurance fund that bought those loans. So they sold it from their right pocket to their left pocket. They just decided to screw grandma's annuity instead of the people who were invested in this OBDC2 fund. That's what they actually ended up doing. And it's not just in this BDCs. It's actually happening in CLO funds also. Riskiest CLO funds are flashing a warning sign, according to Credit Weekly. Fear of rising defaults is spreading from leveraged loan markets to some of the retail funds that ultimately buy the debt as investors get choosier about taking on credit risk. Guys, are you noticing a theme here? Repeating credit risk, lending standards, bad debt. There's worries about this everywhere. The biggest buyers of leveraged loans are money managers that bundle the debt into bonds known as collateralized loan obligations. Some retail funds that buy the riskiest parts of CLOs, known as CLO equity, are slashing their dividends as loan yields fall and anxiety about future defaults mounts. Investors are responding by heading for the exits. Share prices of a handful of closed-end funds, including ones backed by billionaire Koch family and Carlyle Group, fell to all-time lows this week. We'll look at that chart in just a second. While publicly listed CLO equity funds are a relatively small part of the $1.3 trillion CLO market, they illustrate an issue that's drawn scrutiny this week: how debts are being sliced up and the risks are transferred to other investors, including retail holders. Again, if only somebody had been warning us for months that this was happening. Nobody saw this coming. Shares of Blue Owl Capital, for example, closed at the lowest since 2023 after the firm sold $1.4 billion of private credit loans to offer liquidity to retail investors. Analysts at Barclays on Thursday said that at least some of those loans will probably make their way into CLOs managed by Blue Owl, boosting leverage on those assets. Again, Blue Owl's like, oh yeah, our $1.4 billion loan sale proves these loans are worth every bit as much as we say they're worth, which is why we're dumping them into our own CLO funds and dumping them into our own insurance companies. Now, this is the chart that was in that article, and this speaks volumes. All these many lines here, this is showing the value of several of these CLO equity funds since the start of December of last year. So over the last 3 months, now they're all keyed to zero. This is the percentage change in the price of these funds. And you can see they are all down high double digits, some of them down 16%. And the worst, this Oxford Lane Capital Fund is down almost 40% just since the start of December. And again, these are the funds, these are the loans, this is the kind of crap that has been dumped into people's retirement accounts, pensions, IRAs, and 401ks. This has been going on for a year. This isn't just some Twitter rando doomer lunatic on YouTube screaming over and over again about the same thing. This is a fire alarm that keeps going off. Maybe it's because shit's really on fire. Or maybe I'm just a doomer paranoid conspiracy nut. Maybe we'll put the tinfoil hat back on. Why not? Merchandising. Thank you, yogurt. Shifting gears back to my favorite topic. Again, see also doomer, lunatic, tinfoil hat, Twitter rando stuff. OpenAI's leaked financials. Bullish revenue growth amid soaring AI compute costs. The numbers in this leak here are remarkable. Now, this is in Quasa.io. This is derived from this information article. I verified the numbers in this article do line up with what the information said based on what the author from the information tweeted over the weekend. Ahead of a major investment round that could value OpenAI at up to $1 trillion, leaked slides from OpenAI have surfaced, revealing updated financial projections that paint a picture of aggressive growth tempered by enormous spending on AI infrastructure. According to details reported by the information, the Microsoft-backed AI giant has raised its five-year revenue outlook by about 27%. And Sam Altman wants us to stop reading right there, but we must press on, while simultaneously warning of more than double the previously anticipated cash burn through 2030. Let's read that again. More than double the previously anticipated cash burn through 2030. All right, great news. Our revenue is up 27%, but our losses are up 100%. That will total a staggering $665 billion on compute alone. These figures shared by potential investors underscore the high-stakes race in artificial intelligence, where scaling models demands unprecedented capital. Revenue projections went from $13 billion to over $280 billion by 2030. OpenAI's revenue trajectory continues to accelerate, building on a blockbuster 2025. The company reported $13.1 billion in revenue last year, more than tripling from the prior year and exceeding internal forecasts by $100 million, or even surpassing the $10 billion projection mentioned in some of these reports. This growth was driven by surging demand for its ChatGPT subscriptions and AI models. However, those escalating expenses, $665 billion cash burn on the horizon. While revenue soars, costs are skyrocketing even faster. OpenAI now forecasts burning through $665 billion on AI operations and training by 2030, $111 to $112 billion more than prior predictions. This includes $25 billion in expenditures for 2026, $57 billion in 2027, and a combined $30 billion hike from earlier forecasts for just those 2 years. Breaking it down, inference costs running AI models for users totaled over $8 billion in 2025, with $4.5 billion attributed to paid users. These are projected to rise to $14 billion this year and $26 billion next year. Training expenses, crucial for developing next-generation models like GPT-5 variants, hit $8.3 billion last year, but are set to balloon to $32 billion in 2026 and $65 billion in 2027. Cumulative training costs through 2030 could approach $440 billion. These figures reflect immense computational demands of AI advancement, with OpenAI scaling back from earlier boasts of $1.4 trillion infrastructure commitments to a more realistic $600 billion compute target by 2030. Now, that last sentence there is huge. Even though their losses are doubling from what they previously expected, they are cutting in half, more than cutting in half, their spending on compute through 2030, dropping it by $800 billion from $1.4 trillion to $600 billion. How is that not front page news this morning that AI spend at the biggest private company in the world could be cut in half? You'd think that would be bigger news while everybody's talking about insatiable demand. We don't have enough compute, and that's why we're buying half as much as we previously told you we were going to buy, and still our losses are going to double even after that. But don't worry, our revenue, it's up 27%. So ride that rocket, Sam. Good God, what a mess this AI bubble is. Guys, this article is the AI bubble bursting in real time. Again, we got NVIDIA earnings on Wednesday. I'm sure they're going to be magnificent, but will the market care? The last three times it didn't. Meanwhile, we had widespread violence in Mexico yesterday. Mexico strike on powerful cartel boss sparks clashes and U.S. support. A top cartel leader was killed during a raid carried out by Mexican authorities. Look, guys, we're running kind of low on time. I'm sure a lot of you guys saw this. They killed El Mencho. He was one of their big cartel bosses. And the cartels threw a fit. And they killed a whole bunch of people. They blew up a bunch of stuff. They attacked an airport. They burned businesses. They burned a Costco. The U.S. State Department told tourists to shelter in place. Oh, that's always good. Yeah, the cartels running around the street killing people. But stay in your resort room. I haven't seen any articles, any updates this morning on what's going on, if things have calmed down or not. The cartel is basically punishing the country for what they did. Now, will this backfire on them? Widespread violence tends to be bad for business. I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. But if this spills across the border, that could end up having widespread economic impact on the United States. We do something like $980 billion a year in cross-border trade with Mexico in this country. That's almost 4% of GDP. That's a lot of money. And if we start to see the violence spilling across the border in large numbers, it's conceivable that we could see the border get closed. And, well, that trade drops real fast in that situation. So, again, we're a long way from that right now. We'll just have to wait and see how this situation develops. And I just want to say thank you very much to Mr. Nacho Man. Thank you very much, Randy Savage. Nacho Man gifted 20 Nobody Special Finance memberships. Welcome to the Melon Heads, you 20 baby melons. Thank you, Nacho Man. I appreciate that very much. Be sure and say thank you in the chat to Nacho Man if you didn't already. And Mr. Hunt and Cover says, hats off to Mission M&J for pulling extra duty while it's is down. Tinfoil hats tipped to M&J and Mish. Nan, get well soon. I hope things turn out all right for you. And once again, thank you to my mods. Being a moderator on YouTube is a thankless job. And my mods do an excellent job keeping things neat and tidy in the chat here. Thank you guys for everything you do. And thank you, Hunt and Cover, for supporting the channel. Mr. Ryu Kirito 2616, thank you, sir, for the generosity, for supporting the channel. He says, from what I hear, people have told President Trump run a bill through Congress to get rid of all federal income taxes until $250,000 and impose a flat 20% tariff. I can agree with this. Personally, it would save me $24,000 a year. Okay, so let me really think on this. Get rid of all federal income taxes under 250K. So far, so good. I can get down with that. A 20% flat tariff. All right. A 20% flat tariff for most people, considering that we export so or we import so much, the average person, like let's take like the average middle class to lower middle class person, would probably be paying more in taxes under that scenario. Maybe I need to think about that. About the import number there. But would it lead to eventually more jobs? Maybe, maybe not. But again, you have to impose a 20% tariff and then keep it there. That's been kind of a thing for the last couple of years. Keeping them where they're at has proven difficult. I can agree with this personally. It would save me $24,000 a year. Again, I don't know what that would do to retail and consumer prices, to be honest with you. But let me just cut this off halfway. How about we get rid of all federal income tax under $250,000? I'm Jack Gamble, and I agree with this message. Because, hey, remember, up until like the first 140 years of this country, we didn't even have an income tax. And has life for the average person gotten significantly better or more affordable since then? I mean, yeah, technology has progressed, sure. But I'm not really sure the income tax made life better for anybody. I mean, fraudsters certainly made out very well with the income tax. I mean, fraud became so rampant now. I mean, fraud is the rule, not the exception anymore. It's everywhere in Wall Street. Anyway, thank you, Ryu, for supporting the channel, sir. I appreciate that. Mr. BTB Company, thank you very much, sir, for supporting the channel. Says, thanks for the info, Jack. You, sir, are most welcome, and thank you for supporting the channel. Steve Wojtas, 7212, says, Ari, New York City hiring for snow removal. Oh, I saw this one. I could tell where we're going. I hear they received 500,000 applications from a Twin Cities company, Snow Removal Inc. No one showed up. NYC paid. All right. Detecting the sarcasm here. My sarcasm detector is making a little bit of a ding there. Yeah. No one showed up. NYC paid. I saw this story that New York City was like requiring two forms of ID to remove snow, to sign up to be a snow remover. What do you need a permit from the freaking city to charge your neighbor $10 to dig out his car? Is that what they're doing now? Do you have to like pay a licensing fee and show two forms of ID? And by the way, isn't that racist? I heard it was racist to ask for ID, right? Why does that communist mayor not want women and minorities to shovel snow? Why does he want to do that? Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. It's also racist to ask for ID to buy booze, to buy cigarettes, to do anything in life that requires identification. But yeah, okay. Sure. Buy Tylenol. Don't you need to show ID to buy Tylenol in some places now? Not Tylenol. Maybe I'm thinking of like Sudafed or whatever. Anyways, thank you, Steve Wojtas, for supporting the channel, sir. Madison Hype 7221 says, skeptical OpenAI spend go when AI takes dev jobs. Skeptical OpenAI spend go. All right, so when AI takes developer jobs, look, the one use case I'm seeing for artificial intelligence that seems to actually be having an economic impact is in software generation. I mean, it's caused, in my opinion, an overblown panic in software companies. I think a lot of the private credit meltdown has more to do with artificial intelligence failing to deliver on its promises, not being so awesome like the cheerleaders on CNBC want you to think. That being said, skeptical of when it takes developer jobs, it may take developer jobs, but I can tell you even Sam Altman was out in the press last week saying all these stories about layoffs because of AI is really just AI washing. It's executives who don't want to admit that their business is struggling and that they're laying people off because their cash flows suck. Instead, they're just saying some shit about AI, and that's why we're firing people. Even Sam Altman is willing to admit that that's AI washing. So the whole like AI is taking your job thing, I don't really get down with that. But on that subject, let me just say, guys, if you are even considering messing around with this open claw garbage, these AI agents thing, you got to go watch a video that my buddy Carl over at Internet of Bugs put out earlier last week. Understand, if you install an AI agent on your computer, you are backdooring your machine and you are giving bad actors access to freaking everything, every password stored in your browser, freaking everything, every one of your personal documents. Understand what prompt injection means, and then don't use it. I mean, I saw this. There was this article on one of these software websites, and it said how to safely use OpenClaw, and it said step one, don't. So if you're one of these guys like, oh, agentic AI is the future, understand you just backdoored your computer and gave bad actors access to your entire life, and may the odds be ever in your favor. Thank you, Madison Hypes, for supporting the channel. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button. Check out the link down below for George Noble's conference that I'll be presenting at on March 11th. Thank you so much for the super chats and the support of the channel, as well as you magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee. Also, links down below for that good stuff, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I love you guys. Everybody, until next time, live small. Dream big.